Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, watching movies with intention and an Arizona choir that aims to help people with neurological impairments. But first, it is time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
We gave Donald Trump a massive victory. And so when I talk to President Trump on the phone and or in person, he always asks me how Arizona's doing. He loves this state.
What we know is that they're acting in accordance with direction from higher ups in their agency. And I think we're making it clear the kind of activity that we are not okay with. Obviously, they can continue the activity they're doing. But I think it's really harmful.
I'm shocked Katie Hobbs vetoed it. Literally, with my modifications, it just prohibited the government of the People's Republic of China from owning property in Arizona. What is the rational reason anybody would oppose that?
The investments that would need to be made, in particular the add-on pollution controls and the additional expenses to essentially, bring the plan up to a place where it can be reliable for longer term operations, we know that would be significant.
Obviously, in Arizona, we face it more intensely than anywhere else in the country, but extreme heat is hitting all different parts of the country, and we need to have a response plan to deal with this.
And joining me to talk about a proposal to do away with the state income tax, a potential vote to override a gubernatorial veto, and more are Daniel Scarpinato with Winged Victory Agency. Daniel, good morning.
Good morning. Great to see you.
Great to see you as well. And former state lawmaker Aaron Lieberman. Aaron, good morning to you.
Great to be back here.
So let's start, Daniel, with Andy Biggs. He held a rally last weekend where he talked about, among other things, doing away with the state income tax. This is something that your former boss, Governor Doug Ducey, he talked about lowering it, not necessarily getting away with it, doing away with it altogether. But I'm curious what you make of this idea of just saying, okay, no more income tax.
Well, it's a noble goal and one I philosophically agree with. And as you noted, Governor Ducey, what Governor Ducey had talked about was getting the income tax as close to zero as possible. We took it. We actually lowered every bracket down to a 2.5% flat tax, lowest flat tax in the country. Despite that, actually, the budget, the spending in our state budget has grown by 40% since he's left office. So we're able to do that and have resources to invest in things. I think that the challenge here is there's basically kind of three legs to the stool in Arizona when it comes to funding our budget: income tax, property tax, and sales tax. And so can we eliminate it? I think that might be tough. Can and should we continue to chip away at it? Yes, because you have other states. Jared Polis, the Democratic governor of Colorado, recently said he wanted to lower their income tax. Nevada has no income tax. Texas has no income tax. They have other sources of revenue, like gaming and other issues, oil and gas in Texas. So I think that this would be tough to do, but I think the goal of chipping away at it as you have resources to do it is going to grow the economy and overall be good for the state, because we're in a dynamic atmosphere where other states are constantly looking at how to lower and improve their tax code.
Aaron, let me ask you about one of the things Daniel just said in terms of having the resources to do it. Because as you know, having served in the legislature, it is extremely difficult to raise taxes. Finding other sources of revenue is nearly impossible in Arizona. So in terms of either doing away with the income tax or reducing it, obviously there's a competitiveness issue. Daniel mentioned Nevada doesn't have one, Texas, Florida doesn't have one. So there's that kind of argument, but there's also the need to fund state services.
Look, the only problem with those zero tax states is you have to go live there if you want to claim that tax rate. We're playing a winning hand. People are moving here. People love Arizona at our current tax rate. I think this would be a disaster. We're basically a broke state. Look at the budget right now. We're really struggling to meet our basic needs. We don't have things that other states have. We don't have the class size cap that Florida has that makes their public schools the envy of the nation. We don't have any real investments in affordable housing. The things that people care about, the reason we don't have those is because we have so little revenue coming into the state. This would be an absolute disaster. To Daniel's point, you got to get it from somewhere. And all that's going to happen is you'll have to increase property or sales tax. It usually ends up with property taxes going up because that's the easiest way to kind of backdoor it in there. I'll say when I moved back home to Arizona after being gone for a while, our first property tax payment, my wife was, oh, we got to pay this. I thought it was a quarterly payment and was shocked when it was the whole year. I've lived in places where you're paying 25 grand just to, you know, to have your kind of modest house. I think an income tax is actually a much better way to get that. And it doesn't put elderly people on a fixed income and everything else having to wonder if they can keep their house. So this would be a disaster, but I want to reinforce I'm all for Andy Biggs winning his Republican primary. I think this would be a great issue to have in a general election for Governor Katie Hobbs to win on.
Well, so a couple of things. One is that I agree. I think having the low property tax is part of why we've been so attractive for retirees. One of the challenges of doing this, of eliminating the income taxes, we've now done a number of things that are voter protected, like you can't tax services. There's a lot of things that are kind of off the table, mm-hmm. So it's hard to generate other pieces of revenue. I would say, though, to push back on what Mr. Lieberman said, is there's no downside to advocating for lower taxes. And I think Democrats sometimes get caught in this thing of thinking, oh, you know, if he's out there talking about lowering taxes, it's going to be a great issue for Katie Hobbs. I think it's a great issue for Republicans. So I think, the goal and kind of the setting the vision of lowering the tax rate, keeping taxes low, finding ways to continually reform it is something that Arizonans support.
Well, so we have to talk about the political aspect of this, right? He said it at a political rally sponsored by Turning Point USA. He, of course, is in a competitive gubernatorial primary here coming up next year. How does this does this in any way affect the outcome? I mean, you would expect someone like Karen Taylor Robeson to also be in favor of, if not getting doing away with the income tax, of at least lowering taxes broadly. So, like, is this sort of an opening salvo? Like, how do you see this playing in the primary?
Well, it's interesting because going back to 2014 and Governor Ducey, you know, as we talked about, had a kind of a very measured way, in my opinion, of talking about lowering the income tax. Heads exploded when he said that. And actually in that primary, Scott Smith and some other candidates were like, you can't do that. You can't lower the income tax. You're going to blow up the budget. It was a big issue, and I think it helped him win the primary and general. What has changed is that tax policy is no longer a motivating issue for Republican primary voters. It's not really. I actually think if you went to a Republican meeting and said, let's raise taxes to build the wall, you'd have people out of their chairs applauding.
Raising taxes to build the wall.
So I'm not advocating for that.
That's because few of those Republican base members pay a lot in taxes. No, I mean, that's the reality of the situation.
Well, it's because our coalition has changed.
Exactly.
It's more working class. And so whereas 10, 15 years ago, the Steve Forbes flat tax, lowering taxes, all things I believe in as a free market conservative, those aren't, I think, in a Republican primary, issues that are going to light up a room anymore.
Aaron, let me take you back to your days in the State House.
Yep.
Sorry if that is not a pleasant place for you to be. Some of your former colleagues are going to, in the Senate anyway, are going to be put up on the board if they want to override a gubernatorial veto. This is not something that happens frequently. The governor this week vetoed a bill that basically would have barred people associated with the Chinese government from owning property in Arizona. She said it wouldn't really do that much. And Senate President Warren Peterson says, we're going to put this up on the board. We're going to let people vote to override it. Of course, it needs a 2/3 vote. Not a lot of Democrats voted for this bill when it went through the first time. Do you see a lot of Democrats voting to override a governor of their party?
This is going to be a tough one. I don't think it had any Democratic support initially, which honestly is a little bit of a surprise. I think there was an amendment on it. It doesn't look great on its face is really the only thing I can say. It's like, it's not like it's any Chinese landholder. It's literally banning the government of China from owning land in Arizona. I think there's been a lot of good stuff the governor has done around the Saudi Arabian owners of the farms and kind of pushing back on some of this stuff. This feels like there maybe was some inside baseball reason to veto it. It'll be very interesting to see if anyone comes back. The toughest thing when you're down there is going up on the board with that vote that you know could be 20,000 pieces of mail in your district, especially when it's not going to matter. They're not. It'd be incredibly unlikely that they get to enough to override the veto. So you're basically asking people to go vote for something that's not going to happen. That's a tough spot to put people in.
So does this then become a potential campaign issue if Democrats vote against this? Are we going to be seeing mailers about this?
You know, it's an interesting question. I'm of the opinion that one of the things that really hurt our swing district candidates last time was some of the immigration votes where they didn't side with Republicans on some of those things. You've seen a big shift federally. I mean, Ruben Gallego is leading the train on secure borders and all of these things. Most of the Democrats in Congress, including our then, you know, Senator Sinema, wasn't a Democrat at the time, but were much more for secure borders. We haven't seen that in the core Democrats in the state house. And a lot of people like my friend Christine Marsh and others really, you know, it was a big issue. This is like, did anyone think the biggest issue facing Arizona is the ownership of China? Like it seems a little more obscure than that, but it's on its face. It doesn't smell very good.
Daniel, do you see a lot of Democrats going against the governor of their party in an override vote?
No. The last time we had an override was, I think, 1982. It was over redistricting. It actually happens frequently in other states. Some have a simple majority. But for whatever reason, it has been, and I will say there were several times when I was chief of staff where I had to physically go down and prevent veto overrides from
we
happening.
We won't ask you how you did
throw
that.
My body in front of the train. But on this one, it is a bit inconceivable to me of this really does go in the tamale bill category of boneheaded vetoes.
Didn't she sign the tamale bill ultimately?
The next year she did.
It was a political disaster. And this maybe isn't at that level in the public consciousness yet, but it has gotten a lot of attention. There are some real threats to whether it's Palo Verde or our military installations, our water supplies. So I don't really understand. I didn't really understand their rationale. I think the original bill was a better bill, and it kind of got complicated and watered down. Yet, I think they got to think through what fights to pick, and this doesn't seem like a distraction that was needed.
Aaron, you talked about the state of the state budget just a few moments ago. Let's talk about the state of the Arizona Democratic Party budget, which its treasurer says is not fantastic, says it's going to run out of money or could run out of money by the end of the year. There also seems to be a growing effort to oust the new chairman who just took office earlier this year. There's a big meeting coming up this weekend. What is going on here?
I don't speak for all Democrats, but I think Daniel and I sometimes have a contest of like which state party is more screwed up. And we're winning right now at this particular moment. The Democrats are pulling it home. But I think this is a very confusing situation. I do have some friends who are state committee members. I think the previous election where the current chair got elected, it really felt like people were being kind of jammed and not told everything. And it was not necessarily a referendum on the previous chair, who I think many people, she was a record fundraiser, actually did a really good job. A little bit hard because of the election results. We had this red wave. And so, mm-hmm. you know, everyone has to deal with that. But it was just an unusual dynamic that happened there. I think now there's this issue of does the chairman really – does he know how to lead and get to do all of the procedural pieces you need to run a state Democratic Party? I don't actually know on this. I suspect, you know, in the end of the day that there's some Latin term, the thing speaks for itself. Like if you're running out of money and can't bring in more money, then like something's got to change. And I would guess that there will be a change this weekend.
It's a change in leadership?
Yeah. It's a super unfortunate situation that got us to this point. I think the only good news is that it's not like, you know, 2 months before an election when everything has to really come together. Like this is the time to have these kind of inter-family squabbles and have it out and hopefully get it resolved. From our perspective, it's actually unbelievable. In the recent poll, the statewide elected leaders are way more popular than the generic kind of Democratic Party. Like
yeah.
we're playing a winning hand with statewide elected leaders who are doing fantastic and are broadly popular. We need to somehow get our state party organized and supporting those statewide electeds to keep this, you know, the music going.
Daniel, when there's all the sort of the back and forth and the problems going on with the state Republican Party, it's in some ways similar to what's going on now with the state Democratic Party, in some ways very different. But like, how much does all of that impact elections? Like if the state Democratic Party is in a state of turmoil right now, what does that mean for elections coming up in, you know, 17, 18 months?
It's a problem. And it's a obviously, Republicans have been dealing with some of these issues for at least 20 years in Arizona. It does feel like it's a new dynamic on the Democratic side. I think they're going to see more of this because the populist movement is occurring in both parties. You see it with AOC and Bernie Sanders, kind of stars of the show. And so this, I think, is kind of a byproduct of that. The reason I think it's a bigger problem for Democrats is that they've actually done a much more effective job of utilizing existing state laws, loopholes, and the state party. For instance, you can, under Arizona law, raise unlimited amounts of corporate and individual dollars into the state party. And if you look at Katie Hobbs' last two campaigns for Secretary of State and Governor, her entire campaign was through the state party. You avoid all the fundraising limitations. So every ad you saw from Katie Hobbs was paid for by the Arizona Democratic Party, authorized by Katie Hobbs. Republicans haven't done that. We haven't mastered that. So if they can't figure this out, I actually think it is a big impediment for them being as effective as they've been, to their credit, on these statewide races.
Do you think that Robert Branscombe survives this?
I don't know enough about their inner dynamics, but the truth is, you know, you can have Ruben Gallego and Mark Kelly and Katie Hobbs and everybody coming out. I don't know that the rank and file progressive Democrat cares what they think. And so, again, this is something you've seen from the McCain era on the Republican Party, and I think it's happening on the Democrat. They're viewed as the elites, and I don't think that the rank and file activists, I actually think it could sometimes backfires when they get involved in these fights.
That kind of raises the question, though, that if the people who are your party's elected leaders are seen as the elites, like, what's the point?
Daniel hit on a really important thing, which is that coordination with the state party that has been very effective. I think the reality is you've seen a lot of it in, like, independent expenditure spending on the other side. And that's probably where this would go if there was, like, if it couldn't happen this way. It feels slightly less good to write a big check to some sort of anonymously named thing, but it's going to do the same thing. So it just makes it more complicated in how it will play out. This is a thing, to Daniel's point, that both parties really struggle with. The people who are most active are not representative of the broadest swath of even the Democrats or the Republicans, right? They're the hardcore, you know, true believers. And sometimes as a group, or at least by a slight majority of that group, they have kind of a different perspective, certainly than what you need to win statewide in Arizona. And I mean, that's what we see that in the poll numbers right now.
Let me ask you, Aaron, about some of those poll numbers. There's a Noble poll this week that came out that, to your point that you made earlier about the favorability ratings of some Democratic politicians, Mark Kelly plus 15, Ruben Gallego plus 19, Katie Hobbs plus 13. Most Democrats are not getting numbers anywhere near that.
That's the thing. I mean, in particular, I love to point this out for Governor Hobbs, because I think she's unfairly criticized all the time. And, you know, is she going to get reelected? I think most Arizonans see her as a centrist. That's kind of how she's governed. That's where she's been on things. I think her numbers kind of prove that out, that she's kind of running right down the middle. And there really is – we have never seen a path to winning statewide without doing that. It's, you know, Kyrsten Sinema wrote the playbook. Mark Kelly followed it. You know, same with Senator Gallego. Katie Hobbs put her kind of state-based spin on it. And it's really to focus on, like, the issues that most people care about and not try to get drawn into the, you know, extremes. That's the winning hand to win statewide.
What do you make of the fact, Daniel, that these three particular individual Democrats, are their favorability ratings are so much higher than Democrats as a whole?
Well, I have a different view. I actually think what the numbers in this poll and by the way, my slogan is the only poll I believe is ones that I pay for. So I don't know who paid for this. I don't know how it was conducted. But on its face, the real finding to me is that Governor Hobbs's support is incredibly soft. Most Arizonans couldn't pick her out of a lineup. We've seen this in previous polling. So there's very little meat on the bones. I would say that for Republicans, that is an opportunity to define her before she defines herself. But I would say if I'm her team, I would also see some advantages. Perhaps the less people know about her, the better.
Look, again, it's not like she's unknown. She's the governor of the state of Arizona. The state is booming. We have functionally zero unemployment. Like, things are going pretty well.
She's not very visible. I think the numbers show there were a lot of people with no opinion.
I saw her at the Holocaust Museum groundbreaking yesterday. I see her out there. It's a weird thing in what gets covered and not, and controversy leads. Everybody knows that. She's actually done a great job of staying out of the controversial stuff and just kind of trying to get the state to work. I think most people are happy if their, politicians aren't making headlines all the time, but are just doing a good job. And in my perspective, that's what the governor's doing right now. And, we've seen affordable housing bills
like
get signed.
Like China bills.
It's a little confusing. I don't know enough of the details on that. But she signed more affordable housing bills than your, former boss did for sure. We've better funded the affordable housing
more expensive.
Trust fund. And, well, that's because of the runaway, tax cuts you guys pushed on everybody. But.
Well, okay. So let me ask you, obviously, in a year from now, President Trump is not on the ballot.
Yeah.
But if he's around, he's always not far from the ballot. Daniel, this same poll found that President Trump's approval rating is -5, but his favorability rating is basically flat. So, what does that mean?
Well, what it means is everybody wants to write President Trump's political obituary, and it ain't happening. I mean, despite all of the things that have occurred the last 4 or 5 months and throughout his political career— he's still pretty stable. I mean, we're not in George H.W. Bush times anymore where politicians have 80% approval ratings. I actually think that's pretty darn good if you're him to be at that number. To me, the big issue in 2026 when we talk about Governor Hobbs and some of these other races is not our, so the reason Republicans succeeded this last election was historic numbers among Hispanic men, great numbers among independents, a lot of voters who had never voted and people who vote very infrequently. The question for me is not, are these people going to vote for Democrats? I don't believe they will. The question is, are they going to vote? Are they going to come out and vote again? And that, I think, is a piece we don't know and will be critical for Republicans. They need those voters to come out and vote.
Trump, very briefly.
If Trump's not on the ballot, they won't be there. It'll be a good year for Democrats. Trump's going to rile up our independents and our Dems. It'll be just like 2018 when I got elected.
We'll pop the champagne and celebrate.
We'll celebrate on election night, Daniel. That's when we'll be excited.
The only polls that matter are the ones you pay for or the ones on election day.
Those
matter,
exactly.
too.
Exactly.
Right. Aaron Lieberman, Daniel Scarpinato, thanks so much to both of you. I really appreciate it.
Appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how singing in a choir can act as therapy for people with neurological conditions. But first, like a lot of people, Barbara Vandenberg keeps a list of all the movies she watches and writes little capsule reviews of them. But unlike a lot of people, Vandenberg publishes her list and reviews in a pair of long-running threads on X and Blue Sky. In 2024, Vandenberg watched 145 movies. As of this recording, she's up to 76 in 2025. My co-host Sam Dingman is an avid reader of Vandenberg's threads, and when they spoke about it recently, she told him that part of her goal is to encourage people to watch movies with intention.
I don't like watching a movie and doing other things simultaneously. In fact, I hate it. I talk to a lot of people. I have a movie they've seen 5 times on in the background while they're working, and they'll multitask. And for me, I like to be fully invested in whatever piece of media I'm consuming. I don't even like to listen to an album where the music has words and I'm doing something else. I want to be locked in.
Okay, so in that vein, I'm really glad you brought up this idea of how captively you're held by the movie. Because one of the other really fascinating things to me about this ongoing thread that you do is the way that in reading it, it becomes a reflection of other things that are happening in the culture. The movies that you're watching are inflected by other events that are happening. For example, after Gene Hackman passed away, you went on a run of Gene Hackman movies.
I did. And
in the case of the movie The Conversation, you wrote, quote, "Something about watching this in 2025 makes it hit harder than it used to. The loneliness amongst others, the voyeuristic observation of life without participation, the dread of being known. The movie understands the internet age long before its existence." In spite of the fact that, there is this desire to kind of wall yourself off from the interferences of other life factors, obviously, as evidenced by this, life outside of the container of the film experience is interacting with your experience of watching it. How does that relate to your relationship with the idea of immersion?
You know, movies don't exist in a vacuum. They exist in a continuum, and they change as you get older, and they change as society changes. So I love to revisit films that it's been a minute since I've seen. With The Conversation, it's about a man who is listening in on other people. His job is to wire people and listen in and make recordings and catch people and stuff.
Now, look, don't get involved in this, Mr. Cole. Those tapes are dangerous. You know what I mean. Someone may get hurt.
I saw a parallel to how we exist on social media, how we are voyeuristic and looking in on other people, and that's not the same as participating directly in life, and it had me reflecting on that.
Talk to me a little bit about how you decide what you're going to watch on a given night, because with the Gene Hackman films, it makes sense. You know, he was in the news. But recently you watched the film Strange Days, which is a very old movie. What goes through your mind when you're like, what should I watch tonight?
Well, Strange Days is another movie kind of like The Conversation, where it came out in 1995. And so it's before really the popular adoption of the internet. It's before social media sites. And yet so much about Strange Days, much like The Conversation, speaks to the way social media has cooked all of our brains.
This is your life, right here, right now. It's real time. You hear me? Real time. Time to get real, not playback. You understand? She doesn't love you anymore. Maybe she did once, I don't know, but she doesn't now. These are used emotions. It's time to trade them in. Memories were meant to fade, Lenny. They're designed that way for a reason.
The main character, who's played by Ralph Fiennes, is a sort of black market dealer in first-person media. So people wear these devices on their heads that records their experiences through their eyes from their vantage point. And I'm like, oh, this is TikTok before TikTok existed.
Right. Wow.
But
sort of like a proto-Google Glass sort of situation.
Yeah, sort of like that. And it just felt incredibly prescient.
Uh-huh. Tell me what happened on – one that jumped out at me was on February 11th, you watched a movie called Fright Night. Which is a 1985 vampire movie starring Chris Sarandon.
That is my favorite horror film.
Okay.
And it February 11th is my birthday.
Oh.
And they were showing it in 35 millimeter at the Majestic. You know, if you're young and you've never seen a proper film, it's very different from how you're used to seeing movies. They're often old prints and they have a lot of texture to them. So I think that is a perfect 80s horror film. It is my favorite horror film. And Chris Sarandon is just a delightful 80s vampire.
Welcome to Fright Night. For real.
Where's Amy?
Up here. All you have to do is get by me.
Something else that I really enjoy about this ongoing thread that you're doing is that your reviews and evaluations of these films sometimes are written in a sort of like objective tone, but sometimes you're also talking about very personal reactions. How do you think about your critical voice?
It depends. Sometimes I treat it as a diary where it's less about the critical aspects of the film itself and more about where I'm at in life and what I'm feeling and what I'm experiencing. I've journaled off and on most of my life. I find it kind of daunting to look at a blank page and not know where to start, as all people who write or try to write do. And I find that the movies serve as a useful prompt. It's a writing prompt. Hey, I watched a movie today. Let's talk about it a little bit. So I'll end up talking about, you know, I was feeling sad today and I decided to watch this movie and here's why I was feeling sad and here's how the movie either helped or exacerbated the sadness, but there's a catharsis to it.
I'm curious what kind of interactions you have online or offline with people as a result of this thread that you do.
you know, I online it gets fun because people will end up watching movies that I'll talk about. Oh, I watched this movie and it was great. And somebody will be like, oh, I've never seen that. I'm going to go watch it now. And we'll end up having a back and forth in the thread about it. So it does end up being, especially online, a connector. And I have made friends, online friends, who I consider real friends. But I've made online friends just from talking about movies through this thread. And there are people who created their own threads based off my thread. And now I'll watch movies based off their recommendations. And so I just am very gratified to see people experiencing art with this kind of intentionality, because I do think more and more people are second screening their movies and just sort of half paying attention while they're on social media or looking at TikTok. Not to, you know, judge anybody for doing that. Everybody's brain is different. But I don't want to lose that magic of you being held captive, experiencing something in communion with other people. And that's all I was trying to get at when I started these threads, and I think I did.
Well, Barbara Vandenberg is the Manager of Communications and Events at the Sydney Poitier New American Film School at ASU, and is writing this ongoing thread of the movies that she watches on Twitter at Babs Van and on Blue Sky at the same handle. Barbara, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. A choir in northern Arizona aims to help people suffering from Parkinson's disease and other neurological impairments, both physically and mentally. The Mountain Tremors Choir started nearly a decade ago, and other than taking a small break during COVID, has been singing ever since. Faye Murray is an associate clinical professor at NAU in the Communications Sciences and Disorders Department. She was handed the assignment of putting the choir together when she started at the university, after some community members said they knew of similar choirs elsewhere and asked if there could be one in Flagstaff. I spoke with Murray earlier about this, and we started with what it was like in the early years trying to recruit members to come sing and be part of this.
Yeah, so we had three original members that were really staunch supporters of the choir, and they're the ones that began, and they would call their friends, and you know, we would go knock on doors. We went to doctors' offices and such, and initially we were quite small. We had maybe a couple of students who volunteered. We had maybe a director, and then the three main members, and that was it. And slowly we began to grow. After a while, I determined that maybe we should open it up to other neurological impairments. And so we did. We opened it for anyone who felt that they wanted to strengthen their voice for whatever reason. We didn't really want to just limit it to Parkinson's disease. And we also invited their caregivers, family, and, you know, anyone who they wanted to bring with. So that way they didn't feel quite as alone.
Did you find that people were excited to join? Did you kind of have to draw them out? I just wonder, like, if you're going through some of these diseases, yes, maybe you want to strengthen your voice, but you maybe are not so excited about doing it in maybe such a public setting.
People sometimes they'll say, you know, initially they'll say, well, I'm not a good singer, or I can't sing in tune, or don't expect much from me, that sort of thing. So they come in already apologetic about their singing. And that doesn't last very long, because usually, you know, we try to make it comfortable. So this is not a professional choir. You're just expected to just join, just pretend like you're in the shower, you know, in the shower at home. Keep your clothes on, but pretend you're in the shower at home. And so once they see that it's fun and we're just singing, just there's no expectation, they seem to be relaxed, and they might invite a friend. We just try to make it as informal as possible and as enjoyable as possible. And people like the idea of getting out of the house and doing something fun.
Well, so there's been a lot of talk, obviously, about, you know, how being in a choir, the benefits of music, the benefits of singing for people with these kinds of ailments. What is the benefit, or what are the benefits to people with Parkinson's or other neurological impairments of being in a group like this and physically singing?
Well, you know, many times these neurological impairments do affect the voice in many ways, and also your well-being. And so usually people with Parkinson's, for example, have reduced volume. They speak more softly or quietly. They tend to have a more of a monotone voice. and often their speech becomes slurred. Even changes in their rate of speech, they might speak more slowly, or sometimes they have like this rush of speech. It's just like a very difficult, they have difficulty with coordination, and also breast support issues. And all of these things can really be addressed through music. And so when we're singing, we're really focused on that, improving that voice volume. You know, the singing encourages people to project their voice, which counteracts that soft, the hypophonia or the soft speech that we often hear in Parkinson's. We also work a lot on breath support. You know, singing helps strengthen those respiratory muscles, and it really improves that support and that discoordination that people sometimes have with neurological impairments. This exercise of learning how to control your breath actually enhances their overall speech. Also, that we're talking about the discoordination, the muscle discoordination that happens with many of these neurological impairments. The act of singing actually engages various muscle groups which can carry over to speech and other movements. So we work a lot on over enunciating and practicing making your voice, your speech very clear. And so, you know, some of the other things that are unintended, I guess, consequences is the emotional benefits of singing.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that because I'm curious about sort of the psychological, the social potential benefits of being in a group like this, in addition to the physical ones, as you mentioned. It sounds like in some cases, you know, it's a very safe space for the choir members to come because everybody, you know, sort of everybody's got something, right? Like everybody's got some ailment they're dealing with. And it sounds like it almost kind of turns into a bit of a support group, except singing instead of, you know, going around talking about what you're dealing with.
We, you know, we really don't do a lot of talking about what we're dealing with. You know, people come and everybody's got their own thing going on. Even our students, because we do have a lot of students who come in and participate in the choir as well. And we just find that singing brings everybody together. When you're singing, you're evoking memories of, you know, the past, and it has that emotional connection to a time when you were maybe healthy, you know, the peak of your life kind of thing. And so that in itself can also bring you closer to other people who are of similar age. Oh yeah, I remember singing this in my senior prom, or I'm sorry, dancing to this song in my senior prom. And so it makes for community that maybe other activities that are more active wouldn't really, it's a different kind of engagement, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Does this choir ever put on performances?
So that's funny you should ask that. Every semester we have usually like the end of the semester performance. I mean, we've been practicing these songs. There has to be some kind of a performance. And so we do put on like a little mini show. And because of memory issues and sometimes tremors that happen with these impairments, we do it kind of karaoke style so everyone can see the words. And so it's more like a sing-along.
Okay.
But this year we've been asked to sing twice outside of that performance. So we're really excited. We're going to be going to a rehabilitation facility and singing to some folks there that can't really get out and join our choir. And we're hoping to make it a nice big sing-along. And then our own college, the College of Health and Human Services here, have asked us to do some sort of holiday caroling during their annual celebration at the end of the semester.
All right. So when you are planning for a show, like what are the reliable hits that will bring the house down?
The reliable hits. Well, the one song that we have sung over and over again over the years has been Take It Easy by the Eagles.
Okay.
You know, and we always replace Winslow, Arizona with Flagstaff, Arizona.
Naturally. Because, it's an Arizona favorite.
It's an Arizona favorite. So we sing that. This time we're doing New York, New York by Frank Sinatra. And Sweet Caroline is always good because, of course, everybody comes around with, you know, ba, 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 you know.
Right, yeah.
So good, so good. You have the little participation. So we've done some Beatles. I Want to Hold Your Hand. Beatles is always a favorite. But lately it's been Frank Sinatra. I think we did Fly Me to the Moon last semester.
Wow.
So sometimes we go back. At the very beginning, we were in the 40s. And now we're looking like we're doing more 70s type things. So it depends on the age of the group. And Journey is always brings, you know, Journey, Don't Stop Believing.
Yeah.
The other one that's been a big one for us besides Take It Easy is Lean On Me by Bill Withers.
Oh,
it
yeah.
just has, it's a very, it's a little, it's emotional and it's, you know, it's a song, it's a favorite of our group. I don't think we're doing it this time around.
That's such an eclectic song list.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It is. It's very eclectic because, you know, and the choir has to, sometimes we have to convince them. Sometimes it's like, okay, the director, you know, gets a say, and sometimes we have to have them practice it a few times and get them to like it.
All right. Faye Murray with Northern Arizona University and an associate clinical professor there. Thank you so much for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. This has been a lot of fun.
Sweet Caroline, bum, bum, bum. Good times never seem so good, so good, so good, so good. I've been inclined, bum, 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 to believe they never.
Sometimes summer camp is just camp. Other times, it sets your path in life and launches your entire career. In an essay for our Soapbox series, last year, Phoenix writer Michelle Davidson reflected on her time at Girls State.
When I was selected by my high school to attend Arizona Girls State the summer of my junior year, I didn't want to go. Sure, I was a straight-A student who served on the student council and was slated to be the editor of the school newspaper the next year. But I was also an angsty 17-year-old with an attitude problem and a habit of ditching class. Spending a week with 200 other girls in an old, poorly air-conditioned dorm, learning about government sounded positively awful. And worst yet, it was in Tucson. But I knew the program run by the American Legion Auxiliary offered scholarships, and I was hell-bent on attending college, so I decided to go. I drove myself and the two other girls from my school down to Tucson in my boat-like Chevy Caprice Classic, arriving that hot June morning with no idea what to expect. Girls State is a week-long program that brings young women from each state together to create their own mock government and learn about democracy and public service. Arizona Girls State started in 1948 and boasts our current governor, attorney general, and state treasurer as alumni. There is no time to waste in the program. Right after we arrived, we were sorted into our mythical cities, counties, and political parties. There are lots of meetings and speeches. But before I knew it, I was singing the Girls State song and laughing with new friends. I had no idea that I would love every minute of working on our city's budget or writing legislation or helping a new friend run her campaign. Something happens at Girls State. Perhaps it is meeting so many smart, talented, focused young women from all over Arizona. Maybe it is hearing from elected officials and government professionals, many of them women, about how they have impacted their community in positive ways through public service. It could be the shared goal of creating a state, albeit a pretend one, that upholds the values and ideals of 200 young women. It could be the absence of boys. Whatever it is, it is magical. Looking back, I believe that Girls State may have been one of the first times I was ever truly myself. As a teenager who watched the news and read the New York Times, I didn't always fit in with the crowd. But at Girls State, I was surrounded by my peers for the first time. While working on campaign posters and writing speeches, I found a part of myself, and I made lifelong friends. The legislation and party platforms may have been made up, but the intentions and determination behind them were not. Girls State ignited my own passion for politics. I have worked on dozens of campaigns for an attorney general, a governor, and a U.S. senator. I have also continued to volunteer for the Girls State program. Earlier this month, I made that same drive to Tucson again, 30 years later, to drop off my daughter for her own week at Girls State. Thankfully, she had a much better attitude about it going in than I did. And while she may not follow me into a career in politics, I know the magic of Girls State will stay with her forever.
Come to this land of sunshine, to this land where life is young, where the wide, wide.
That was Michelle Davidson. As for her daughter, who attended Girls State last summer, she just graduated from high school with honors and begins college this fall, where she plans to major in government.
Into warm, white, shining day, and the sons of men are blazing, their priceless right of way. Sing the song that's in your hearts.
And that'll do it for this Friday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for being along. Remember, you can sign up for the show's weekly newsletter. It is called Radioheads. You can do that at tinyurl.com/theshowradioheads. The show was produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayanna Hamilton, as well as Bruce Drummond. Sky Shouts, our digital editor, Chad Snow, the news director. The show was created by John Hoban. Our executive producer is Amy Silverman. For Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Have a great weekend. Hope to have you right back here on Monday.